The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
I got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. Our subject this week is Vietnam and the Revolutionary War in America. My guest is retired Army Lieutenant General David Palmer, author of Summons of the Trumpet, U.S. Vietnam in Perspective. He's a well-known military historian who specializes in the campaigns of George Washington and the 18th century American Army. Often appears on television to comment in documentaries about the Revolutionary War and its generals. He's the author of many books, including The Summons of the Trumpet, and his most recent book is George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots. General Palmer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on, James. Good to be here.
I want to start with maybe an unorthodox way by quoting from somebody else's study on Vietnam, Lewis Sorley's book, A Better War. He wrote, "There came a time when the war was won. The fighting wasn't over, but the war was won. This achievement can probably best be dated in late 1970. I was interested in reading your book, your suggestion that much earlier, in 1964, in fact, well before the massive U.S. intervention, the war or the struggle was being won, and that recognition of that in Hanoi led to fundamental changes in North Vietnam's strategy that would later prompt the United States to get involved. How was it being won in 1964?
Well, first of all, one of the problems with people understanding the Vietnam War is it was really several wars. Up until the time in late 64, when the North Vietnamese sent their own troops down, it was a pure insurgency with the Viet Cong and the South Vietnamese, with American advice, waging the war. Then it later became a mixture, and then later it was U.S. forces versus North Vietnamese forces. It was different at different times. And the decision that the North made to commit troops, and they made the decision in the middle of 1964, would have been for one of two reasons. They would have either thought that they were winning the war, and therefore they could commit troops for the coup de grace to take over, or they could have believed that the long-range trends were against them, and they had to commit troops to stop the momentum which was going their way. And you could argue it either way. I happen to believe that in the North Vietnamese looked at it at that point and said, as things are going, with the South Vietnamese army getting better, with the American involvement getting stronger, we cannot anticipate that in the long run we'll win the war. So they made a decision, I think, to accelerate events and keep the momentum going their way in 64.
But in making that decision, they clearly made some serious miscalculations about what the United States' response would be.
Well, they did. They believed the political rhetoric they were hearing back here. 1964 was a presidential election year, and Lyndon B. Johnson was running, and he made the claim that we will never send American boys over to do what Vietnamese boys ought to do. Mm-hmm. And the Vietnamese, not understanding that politicians make promises that they don't always believe, apparently took him at his word and figured there would not be American forces. Obviously, what happened, though, as you and students of the war would know, is their invasion in turn triggered the commitment of actual U.S. combat troops in early and mid-1965.
Well, that set the stage for a lot that followed. More than half a million U.S. troops, on and off bombing campaigns, negotiations also on and off, mounting casualties, growing anti-war sentiment, etc. And all the while, the question of what we were doing never got answered. You make that point very clear when you talk about Rocky Blyer, the Pittsburgh Steeler, beginning of the book. For soldiers, as you point out, not in basic training, not en route, not in their units in Vietnam, and the same was true here at home. Why was this conflict so incomprehensible?
Well, I have to say that if the only honest and candid answer to that is that President Johnson was trying to wage war on the cheap. He did not want to commit American forces completely. He never called up the reserves. He wanted to have guns and butter. And as a result, the American people were never mobilized to understand what we were doing. The American military, other than to be told you're going over there and you're going to have a mission, of doing tactically doing this or doing that, the overall purpose was never really articulated.
Well, that's incomprehensible, all right, but it seems to me it went right up the chain of command. Page 111 of your book, I find a striking paragraph. General Westmoreland, on whose shoulders fell the task of actually conducting the fighting inside South Vietnam, had fairly explicit directives on what he was not to do, imprecise instructions on what he was expected to accomplish, and very vague information on what he would have on hand to do it with. His limitations and strictures were carefully delineated. His missions and resources were left more or less open for interpretation. What kind of way is that to conduct a war?
Well, I have to say, from a soldier's standpoint, it's a terrible way to do it. When you send a military commander and his units into battle, you give them very clear mission, very clear statement of what it is they are to do and what resources they'll have. That was left open-ended. The amount of resources he could anticipate was never, it was left open-ended, and exactly his mission was left open-ended. In a lecture one time came up with a hypothetical discussion between General Westmoreland and President Johnson, one that never took place, but all of the statements in it came from various writings or statements that one or the other had made. It goes, President Johnson says, General Westmoreland, go over there and win the war. And he says, all right, Mr. President, what I'll do is I'll go into North Vietnam at the source of the aggression. No, 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 you have to stay inside South Vietnam. He said, well, then if I can't go in the north, I'll cut off the infiltration over into Laos. No, no, you have to stay inside the borders of South Vietnam. Then if I understand what I'm supposed to do, I'm supposed to stand here and wait, and when they come across the border, then I punch them until they get tired, and they go back across the border. But I'm not supposed to follow them. Johnson says, you understand it perfectly, General. Now go out there and win.
General Harry Kennard was a guest on this program a few weeks ago, and as you know, he commanded the 1st Cav Division Vietnam. And he said that he had the mobility and the capability to conduct that pursuit, particularly into Cambodia. And he said it's was his single biggest frustration for having to stop at the border every time the enemy units retreated behind it.
Yes. Later in the war, of course, when you have a different president and a different commander, we did cross over into Cambodia and cross over into Laos. It was pretty late in the war for the United States. We had already made the decision to leave it, to get out and come home. If we had done in 1965 what we actually did in 1970, things would have been very, very different.
Well, the White House and the Pentagon obviously were micromanaging just about everything. I mean, people in the White House designating targets for bombing, denying requests from the field to target specific facilities and infrastructure. I was amused by your quote of General Wheeler, who said the best way to improve the effectiveness of the bombing would be for Washington to help the field commanders less. How do you view this complex and often costly interconnection of policy, politics, and battle?
It is set in history over and over again that politicians should keep their hands away from things that go on in the battlefield. It's their job to set overall missions, to pick the forces, to agree on the national strategy, but they shouldn't mess around with what goes on in the fighting itself. Yes, you're right. Lyndon Johnson personally approved bombing lists, something much better left to Air Force leaders on the ground, Air Force and Navy, the people doing the bombing in the North, to leave them, tell them what their mission was, and let them go perform the mission.
But isn't it also the case that all the blame doesn't lie there? And you point that out in your book, and several other people have, too. General Westmoreland comes across in many things I've read as never really grasping or acknowledging that the war was basically a political contest, not just a military one. His successor, Creighton Abrams, did understand that, so I suspect Ambassador Bunker did. So did Bill Colby, who later became head of the CIA. And there was a sea change in strategy, tactics, and policy after Abrams replaced Westmoreland.
Well, yes, but you've got to put it in the context. Put it in the context of the war. 1964 and 65, when Westmoreland shows up on the scene, and you have McNamara and Lyndon B. Johnson back in Washington running things, and then look at the war in 1968-69 when Abrams comes on the scene. You have Nixon and Kissinger back in the United States. And by the time Abrams becomes the commander, the decision, our national decision, had been made that we're getting out. The question was how fast, and how would we leave?
We're going to take a break right there on that note, General, and we'll come back and continue our conversation right after we pause for some messages. Our guest today is retired Army Lieutenant General Dave Palmer, author of Summons of the Trumpet, U.S. Vietnam in Perspective. We'll be right back.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Our guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant General Dave Palmer, former superintendent of West Point, a graduate of West Point, two tours of duty in Vietnam, a well-known military historian, author of Summons of the Trumpet, U.S. Vietnam in Perspective, many other books. He actually specializes in the American Revolutionary period, and his newest book is George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots, and we're going to be discussing that a little bit later in the program. Right now, I want to continue on for this segment about Vietnam. What about the role of the media, General Palmer, how they affected the eventual outcome of this?
Well, that is one of the fascinating stories of that war, because while we've always had media reporters covering wars, this was the first time that we had one covered with television. So people could not only read reports or hear radio pronouncements from the front, they could actually see on their screen what was going on. That made war to the American public much more, much closer, much more imminent. And we, as a people, weren't sure how to take wars that way, nor was the media sure how it ought to go about portraying war that way. It was learning on both sides. And, of course, you've seen it in modern days now with digital technology, where you can actually have a video cam from the war. You don't have to tape it and mail it back. You can see it as it's happening. So how we view wars is different. That's one aspect. Another aspect would be the sort of sad commentary that many in the media, both reporters in field and their editors back at home, had a specific agenda that they wanted to make. They would color reports, doctor reports, and by editing what they would show and what they would not show, portray the picture that they wanted. I know people from Vietnam, much as everyone today in Iraq, the soldiers who are actually there, they come back and look at the coverage today and shake their heads. They say, that doesn't square with reality as I just lived it.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty true. It wasn't as instantaneous, rather, as it is now, but it was true then.
Well, Kais Beach was a very distinguished journalist who covered Vietnam, an old Asia hand. He once said, the press corps in Vietnam divided into two groups, those who wanted to win the war and those who wanted to lose it. I belonged to the former. Few members of the latter group would admit it, but only by losing the war could they be proved right.
Well, and there's some truth in that. I personally don't recall ever meeting a reporter who strictly wanted to just report it, just tell what was happening. They had an agenda, whether it was their personal agenda or the editorial policy of the news outlet they were working for.
What do we learn from Vietnam that you might consider applicable to Iraq? Can the Abrams doctrine of clear and hold work in a large urban environment? Can pacification be possible in an environment of sectarian strife?
One has to be very, very careful of trying to draw parallels, because the circumstances and the situation are so distinct. But there is one. You clearly, when you have an insurgency, whether it's fomented by someone on the outside or whether it's, as we see, sectarian groups opposing one another, whatever its source, you have to isolate it. It has to be isolated from outside support, money, material, moral support, and so forth. We were not able to do that in Vietnam because we chose not to cross the border, and we chose to bomb the North in such a way that it was, with very few exceptions, it was more a slap on the wrist than a painful bombing. We have not yet indicated, so far as I can see or read, we have not indicated any willingness or ability to seal the borders, to stop support coming in from Iran, support in the form of money and of supplies and of encouragement, perhaps bringing out some of the individuals to train them in Iran and then putting them back. And until you can seal off the battlefield, when you have an internal war, that's one of the lessons of Vietnam. I think it's one of the lessons that of Afghanistan and Iraq and other modern wars. When you're talking about an enemy that is not a state, that is not another country, it's an ideology, it's a movement, it's a religion.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to take another break, and we'll continue our conversation with General Dave Palmer and talk about his latest book, George Washington and Benedict Arnold, when we come back.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest space.
Cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Lieutenant General Dave Palmer, a military historian, former superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, well-known commentator on television about the Revolutionary War period and its generals, and his most recent book is, in fact, about that very period. It's George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots. That's a interesting pairing, General. I know that they had similar backgrounds and that Washington was very much enamored of Benedict Arnold as a commander and as a general, but they sure went down different paths.
Well, that's exactly, Gene, why I paired them. They are in so many ways very similar. They had similar backgrounds, as you mentioned. The two of them were the two leading celebrities of the Revolutionary War in the first 3 years, 1775, 76, 77. Those were the two men who gained the victories, who established the circumstances that led to our eventual winning of the war. Without either of them, it's hard to see how we could have won our independence. And during that time, both of them also had severe criticism. There were people, politicians and other military folks, who wanted to get rid of them, replace them.
Well, they were victims of their own success and celebrity at that point, I should think.
Well, there was an element of jealousy, very much so. And they got caught also between jealousy between New England colonies, for instance, and New York. And in all of that adversity, all of that pressure. One, George Washington stayed above the fray, kept his eye on the goal of winning the war, and emerged as the father of our country. The other man, although, however, crumbled under adversity and became a man without a country.
Well, what was the basic source of his statement that his honor had been impugned, honor as a sacrifice no man ought to make, he stated. What brought all this on?
He had been a tremendous, the best we had, battlefield commander, both the British and the Americans thought so. However, for strictly political reasons, he was not promoted when he should have been. He was the most senior brigadier general and was not promoted to the next rank, which was the highest rank we had at that time. Washington wanted him promoted. He was the first one on his promotion list, but the Continental Congress, for political reasons, wouldn't do it. Arnold was miffed by that. Then he was seriously wounded in his last battle, and during his long convalescence, he had a change of heart. He said, well, I'm not appreciated, and if they aren't going to give me what is my due, then I'm going to use my position to make money. He had been a very wealthy man before the war and had lost his fortune in the war, supplying his own troops in many cases. And when he started doing unethical things to make money, he was on a very slippery slope. He got into more fusses, ran into more antagonism, and eventually became not just a bitter man bent on vindication, but he became a very angry man bent on revenge. And that was when he decided not just to go to the British, but to go to the British in such a way that he would bring along with him the critical strategic center of the United States and cause the Patriot cause to be lost.
But did his wife not give him a push in that direction?
Oh, yes, yes. Usually when someone has problems, there's sex or money or prestige involved, or all three.
All of the above.
And in this case, all three were involved, money and prestige. But he also, at the same time, he was 36 years old. His wife had died in the first year of the war. And he married an 18-year-old girl from Philadelphia who was a loyalist. She had consorted with British officers during their occupation of the city of Philadelphia. Within 2 weeks of their marriage, the two of them together had managed to make the decision that they would go over to the other side, revert to being British citizens, and Arnold would become a traitor. She was very much involved in that along with him.
How much damage did he actually do then?
Well, ironically, he did no damage. As it turned out, he did some good. Because his treason was caught at the very last minute, and the West Point, the fortification of West Point on the Hudson River in New York, was the strategic fortification in the entire war. The British believed if they could get that, they'd win the war. The Americans believed if the British got it, the Americans would lose the war. Arnold had himself made the commander of that and was going to turn over the keys, so to speak, to the British. By just good fortune, at the very last minute, the man who was carrying back the maps and the instructions to the British was caught, and the treason was discovered. And Arnold made his escape to the British, became a British general, and the treason was never consummated. They never got West Point and didn't win the war. But the nearness of it actually scared the jabbers out of the Americans, and they thought Providence, God, was on their side, or else that would not have happened. So at a very low point in the Revolution, when one more blow might have sunk the war, this turned out to be a morale booster that Arnold was caught.
You say he became a British general. What role did he continue to play during the war on that side?
Within very short time, he was given troops and sent as the commander of an expedition to raid Virginia. He went down there, chased Thomas Jefferson, the governor, back into the mountains, and destroyed supplies and facilities in the state, the colony of Virginia. Then he came back to New York, was given another force, and led a raid into Connecticut near his hometown, where he burned the town of New London, and to the people there in Connecticut, to their everlasting chagrin, their Connecticut son came home and helped destroy a key part of that state. Then he went to England before the war ended and never returned.
Had 9 children. That's a lot. Interesting contrast there, too, because George Washington fathered none.
It is interesting. And because Benedict Arnold's name was erased from the register and the name became a synonym for a traitor, his son, who was named Benedict Arnold, was killed. And that was the last Benedict Arnold ever, because no one named Arnold would name their boy Benedict nowadays.
Is it not the case that at West Point his name is left off of a portrait of some kind somewhere that of American Revolutionary generals?
Yes, there's an interesting array of plaques. The Continental Congress decreed and George Washington decreed that the name of Benedict Arnold would be erased from our history, would not be used. And in the old cadet chapel down in the cemetery, on the right wall, there's a row of plaques, small, simple, black plaques, and each one has just 4 entries. It has a name, a rank, date of birth, and a date of death, except the very last one in the row. And you can't get away from the fact, the historical fact, that Arnold was a general in that war. So there's a plaque there. It has no name, however, where the name would be, it's blank. It has a rank, major general. It has a date of birth, the year he was born. It has no date of death. And the symbolism is pretty clear. Traitors are non-persons. They have no names. And they don't die. They just go away.
I've been to the parade field at West Point. What you have just described is in stark contrast to the way Washington is remembered there.
Yes, his in the very center of West Point, the most dominating monument there is one of a larger-than-life statue of General Washington on his horse with his hand outstretched pointing to the future. Washington, on one hand, is a man of monuments. There's a state named Washington. I think every state in the Union has a county named Washington. Pictures and books and prints and statues without number, whereas Arnold is a man without a monument.
What did your research into this, your writing of it, and your reflection about it tell you about character?
That it is the bedrock of leadership. Leaders, and especially military leaders, have to have meet 2 requirements. They have to be competent, and they have to be leaders of character. Now, competence changes all the time. In the time we're talking about, in the Revolution, to be a successful battlefield commander, you had to be a good horseman. You led on horseback. Whereas in Vietnam, your other war this week, I doubt if any of the generals over there had been on a horse in 10 years or more. It was not a requirement. However, they have to, nowadays, if you don't know digital communications, you're not going to be competent. So while competence changes all the time, character, the essential, unchanging ingredient of leadership, never changes. It's the basis for it, and it was the same in ancient Greece. It was the same in our Civil War. It's the same today. You must be not a leader, but a leader of character.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that Washington and Arnold had a mutual respect for each other. Was that confined to their wartime experience, or were they pals, if you will, before the war?
It was wartime. They had met, but briefly, in Philadelphia during the First Continental Congress in the fall of 1774. But it was really Arnold's initiative in the first weeks of the war that got Washington's attention. And from that point on, any time George Washington needed someone to operate independently, he would send Arnold to do it. Their relationship, if you look for parallels in more modern times, might be like Eisenhower in Europe in World War II and George Patton. Eisenhower was the overall commander, and Patton was the battlefield leader without peer. And while he got in trouble from time to time because of his personality, Eisenhower recognized how valuable he was as a warrior and always stood up for him, protected him, and kept him there. And the same thing happened with Washington and Arnold.
That's interesting. You mentioned Patton because there was a horseman of renown.
Yes, he was.
And a leader of renown.
A great polo player, yes.
No question about that. Well, it's called George Washington and Benedict Arnold, The Tale of Two Patriots. The author is General Dave Palmer, a retired lieutenant general of the United States Army. Spent two tours in Vietnam, 5 years as superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And you may catch him on television, possibly on the History Channel, if you're tuned into there, because he often appears as a commentator in television documentaries about the Revolutionary period. General Palmer, it's been a great pleasure and privilege, and we thank you so much for your time and your insights.
I've enjoyed it, Gene. Thanks for including me.
We'll have you again.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pellcom Communications. Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.